Hey, you got the morning show here on Raglan Community Radio, and in the studio I've got John Lawson. Morning, John.
Sun's shining, wind's blowing.
Thank you for the weather update. It's barely shining. It is out at the moment. It's not going to be a great day for the sun.
Wet.
No, tomorrow's going to be a great day for the sunshine, though. I'm looking forward to that. Tomorrow's also the day of the community board meeting, going to be held at the Tomato Hall. How are you getting there, John?
I haven't decided whether I'm catching the bus that gets there for 2 o'clock or whether I'm going to get there in time for the questions, which start at 1:30.
That's last time they had the meeting at Tiuku, there were quite a few people turned up. the one at Tomato, hardly anyone at Tomato knew the meeting was happening there, unfortunately. But Tiuku, there were a lot of people. So the Q&A for us pretend journalists could be interesting. So anyway, 1:30.
Might be worth getting there earlier then.
Yeah. Oh, I hope they do something. It's such an echo chamber in that hall.
And the wind's blowing the right way. So.
Or we could just jump. If it's strong enough, we just jump up off Manukau Road and get blown there. So anyway, that's just such a stupid thing to say. Let's talk about what's on the agenda for the community board meeting. John, why is buses first? Is that because you wrote this up?
Yes, but they do feature quite prominently in the community board agenda for the first time for a long time. Because we're actually getting some more buses, which is surprising given the government attitude to public transport, but they have increased the amount of funding for buses, even though it's not all that much, but nothing
was
compared with what's being increased for roads. But
I thought this was disguising some bad news.
The bad news is that they were looking at spending $100,000 a year on a local bus, and they've decided that, what's the wording, unlikely to proceed due to cost and conflict with the existing Raglan shuttle service. And they've also written a reply to somebody who complained about that, saying this would be more beneficial to be done by local shuttle companies that were already in operation in the area. Therefore, we have no plans to do anything in this space, and I haven't heard of any local shuttle operators going to start doing anything. Maybe you could approach them. It seems rather odd to suggest that somebody as an individual might approach them.
So on the one hand, the council has not had support from the other funding organisations. That there's usually there's three funders for bus services, so I understand that it's difficult. But that thing about Raglan shuttle services, that sounds like an excuse that they've thought up on in the moment. I have to be honest, because we've been talking about this for 3 or 4 years now, and at no stage has anyone said, oh, but what about Raglan shuttle service? I know they tried to run, admittedly during COVID or around that time,
a regular
service, and it didn't take off for them at all.
Yeah, they were charging $5 a trip, which is fairly expensive for a local trip around Raglan, but obviously cheaper than the taxi fare.
But that's because they're not subsidised.
Yes.
Unlike the conventional bus services through the council.
Well, unlike every other vehicle on the road, yeah.
Okay.
I don't pay anything to ride my bike on the roads, and drivers don't pay anywhere near the full amount of the costs of the roads.
Right.
I pay over $1,000 a year to subsidise them in my rates.
But isn't there
and
a petrol tax
as well? So.
Petrol tax, John, petrol tax?
Yeah, but that covers about two-thirds of the cost, but the other third is covered by rates and taxes.
Okay, all right. So I've opened a can of worms here. But basically, we're not getting that internal bus service, despite years of sort of trying. I suspect.
Well, not unless lots of other people write in and complain, in which case they might run a bit thin on this talking to Raglan Shuttle.
There are questions about whether it would be viable in the small town. I know when I interviewed Andrew Stump, who owns the Wahine Moe and the new Wakahuia, that I asked him, you know, what did he think about that? And he thought about it for quite a while before he answered. So it's obviously like, you know, it wasn't something he jumped out and said, yep, that'll work.
So. It depends what you compare it with, because we've just spent $250,000 on a couple of car parks, and that would easily subsidise the bus for the next 5 years. So,
John, you bring up these these tricky things. You're very tricky, John. Council doesn't like it.
Yeah, but if you think about it, people who
don't drive,
don't use car parks, and they use buses. And my argument, it's cheaper to subsidise a bus than it is to rebuild car parks.
So which car parks?
Papahua and the one at the main reserve, Wainui Reserve.
Okay.
So each of those has cost about $250,000. So we've got $500,000 that's been spent on those, and we're going to have to sort out the problem of parking in town at some stage. And this whole question of the local bus came up because there were complaints from the businesses down at the wharf that there wasn't enough parking down there. And we've spent $6 million improving the wharf, but there's still no more car parks down there. So that problem is probably worse than it ever was, because more people are going to want to go there and no yep. more car parks for them. So somehow that needs to be sorted out.
Well, the side of Raglan that thinks we've already got too many tourists coming will be perfectly happy to have inadequate car parks and for Raglan to get a reputation as a place you can't get a park. But Raglan friends, what we consider to be lack of car parks, Auckland is considered to be perfectly adequate, quite close compared to what they're used to. So I don't know how that's going to play out. Your point about spending some money when they could have spent that money on buses, to be fair, they would have had to spend the money on those car parks, because people are still, it would take a profoundly different public transport service for people to come out from Hamilton and not use their cars in the numbers we'd like. It would have to be like a bus every 20 minutes from the Hamilton Transport Centre, and then have to be really reliable buses to get people to the Hamilton Transport Centre, and a change of culture in the country, which I'm not saying it won't happen, but it won't happen this year.
Because we've got the amount of traffic to support that, but we don't have the governments that have ever been willing to put it into operation. Because ever since the 1920s, we've been subsidising road transport and discouraging public transport.
Well, we've got a government now where one of the ministers was talking about how great it was that we could drive fast again. So, because the law changes they're bringing in. So, not those exact words, but that was the sentiment.
But you still not changed the speed limits for trucks and buses, so they're still going to hold everyone up as they trundle along at 90.
Why should they? Why shouldn't they go faster, John? Can they go faster?
Well, the argument is it's dangerous, and it's dangerous for anyone to go faster. and it's in other countries, trucks and buses do go faster.
Oh, really? So is it just because they're big and scary looking?
Well, the faster you go, the more damage you cause if you crash into something. So
I've heard that.
Trucks are responsible for about 17% of deaths on the roads.
And they are how many, what proportion of vehicles?
About half that.
Okay.
In terms of proportion of trucks on the road. So.
Yeah, because when they do crash, it certainly is a mess.
There's all sorts of arguments. But, I mean, we are, in fact, getting some improvement. So we're not getting that local bus, but we are
getting
an extra bus at weekends. And we are getting, so there's going to be 3 instead of 2 buses at weekends. And there's going to be a couple of buses a day that carry on to Manu Bay, Waikerie.
Yeah.
Rather than stopping at Raglan West. It seems to me that that's a waste of the extra money, because whenever I've travelled on that bus, I've usually been the only passenger, and I've talked to a driver who says, oh, usually I don't have anyone on this bus.
Is that a... I guess why? If they did it for long enough, would people get used to it? Or should they just do it for those weekend buses?
Well, the problem is the timing that they're suggesting. It fits in well with operating a bus, but it doesn't fit in with people wanting to use a bus. So if you live down the Whanganui coast there somewhere and you're hoping you might now have a usable bus, then you're going to have a bus that takes you to Hamilton in the morning and brings you back in the morning and leaves you an hour and 19 minutes in Hamilton.
Will you be mentioning this at the community board meeting, John?
Well, if I get there in time, yes. Depends okay. whether I catch the bus or cycle.
I'll announce, John wanted to be here to complain about the buses, but the bus is bringing him too late. the bus service is not going to be set up just for one community board meeting a year in Tiuku, but it's kind of ironic.
Well, I think they might organise the community board meeting, fit in with the buses, which it could do. Because there is also a bus that they could all catch back, and they could all be very environmentally friendly and have a pre-meeting and post-meeting on the bus.
Yeah, okay.
That's not going to happen, because we don't have community board members who catch the bus. And I used to see Bob McLeod occasionally on the bus, but
most people
since
don't.
He's gone, I've not seen any community board members.
Yeah, like you've always said, it would take a... Well, my interpretation of what you say would take a profound change to the public transport landscape in this country to make bus services that really are convenient for people. Because yep. we live in a modern world full of conveniences,
Well, so do other countries, but they have much higher use of public transport.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. They've made their buses more convenient because people just assume that you can have convenience because, I mean, look at our world that we live in.
Because the village I was brought up in the UK still has an hourly bus service, but it's a quarter the size of Raglan, and it's got four times as many buses, so, plus buses to the local villages as well. So it's like having a bus to Marta or something.
The population more densely packed?
No.
Isn't it? I thought the houses are closer.
It's a quarter the size of Raglan.
The houses, I've been to the UK, the houses are all much closer together. It's got terraced houses.
They are in the cities, but not in the villages. So.
What village? You grew up in a nice village, John?
Yes.
What's it called?
Castleton.
Castleton. Okay, we'll look that up. Maybe that's Castleton, not Castleton.
Yeah, I have to try hard these days to say Castleton and not Castleton.
Yeah, you've been here too long. okay, so the next thing on the list after buses, if we're done with buses, is the Mano Bay Breakwater, the gift that keeps on giving as far as we're concerned. Actually, no, I'm sick of it here in the studio. We are.
Well, it's not giving, it's taking away now.
Yeah. Sorry, we're. What have we got? Oh, look, okay. Well, come and see me at 10.
We've got a visitor in the studio, but I'll talk about Mano Bay Breakwater whilst Aaron negotiates. So.
Yeah.
the Mano Bay Breakwater, they've been looking at it for years. They've done several reports. I've not seen a total of how much it's cost so far, but those reports must have cost quite a bit. And now the council says that stakeholder consensus is currently unachievable. So that means the boaties and the surfers can't agree. And because of this, the current recommendation going to council will be to not continue the process. So $2 million saved to the ratepayer.
Aside from all the extra costs up until this point,
yes,
and like having talking with Dennis Amor, community board chairperson on Friday, and also a member of the fishing club, he thinks, and I do tend to agree, that the council has sort of abandoned its responsibility to actually make a decision just because the stakeholders can't all agree. I mean, when on earth do you ever get everyone in your community agreeing about a solution? You never do. And so if that was a prerequisite for making a decision, then nothing ever would get done anywhere. And council is used to saying, okay, we've consulted, we've got a fair amount of people supporting this, so we're going to do something. But in this case, they're just saying nah.
Well, maybe they have made a decision, but they rather like the buses and the local shuttle service. They're blaming the stakeholders who can't reach agreement, and rather similar to blaming Raglan Shuttle for not running a bus.
Yeah.
It's not our fault. Somebody else has done this.
An important thing to consider in the background is that the fishing club got lawyers involved because they weren't happy with what was happening a few years ago. John, will they get lawyers involved again, do you think?
I'm guessing they're talking to them at the moment, but I can't see it. There's much you can do if a council says we're not going to spend money and we can't get agreement, and they can go to a court and say, oh, look, we've been through all this process, and don't you think it's reasonable that we stop at this stage?
Yeah. My observation would be that the fishing club hasn't generated a lot of goodwill at council, so I imagine that's not helping their cause. Would you? You've worked inside these sorts of organisations, John. Would you imagine that has not helped their cause?
Well, you could say that for lots of organisations, but they actually get what they want because they've got the money. So you can say that about developers. You can say it about horse riders on the beach. There's all sorts of groups that you can look at and say they use their money to actually get something out of council, and council usually just goes along with it as the line of least resistance. But in this case, they maybe because they're going to have to spend $2 million to sort it out, they've decided that that they've got this excuse of stakeholders can't agree, so we're not going to do any more.
So all those times I was trying to get council to do something about the flooding at Papahua, I should have just gone in like angry and shouted at them.
Well, you should have gone to see your lawyer and got them to send a letter, but you didn't have the sort of money lying around that will employ lawyers.
I also don't like destroying relationships.
We don't pay you well enough at the radio.
Yeah. Having said that, we're actually going to talk about the soccer fields in a little while, but that's where the Mano Bay Breakwater is at. They're not doing And it specifically says, it was clear at the workshop that stakeholder consensus is currently unachievable and each group confirmed their stance on supporting the process further or not. The Open Spaces team will work with the Raglan Sports Fishing Club to improve the level of service at the boat ramp in relation to safety or maintenance measures. Does that mean they're going to check it all the time? I've seen photos, folks. What you need to understand is those big round boulders. I have seen photos of those boulders sitting on the lower levels of the boat ramp. And depending on the tide level, they might be just below the water surface level when you're bringing your boat back, and you might not see them. And you know what will happen in that situation. So it has been a problem. They have dug out a lot of the boulders from the other side of the current break wall.
I hoped it was going to solve the problem, but it didn't.
It didn't? So there's still boulders getting around.
Well, that's my understanding, yeah.
Okay. Because they tried to basically clear out the boulders from where they thought they were coming from. Eventually that hole would have filled back in anyway, but it would have taken quite a few years, hopefully. But it hasn't worked anyway. So they're going to have to just put a watch on the ramp.
I suppose it takes a while to rack up a bill of $2 million if you're just sending a digger down there from time to time to pull some boulders off the ramp.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to everyone, at the basis of the conflict is the fact that what you need for launching boats and what you need for surfing are contradictory.
Like, yeah, and that's a national surfing spot, so it's nationally protected.
Yeah, so they're not allowed to put a wall back like the old one is basically what that says, isn't it? Like the old one that was just vertical.
Well, unless they can reach agreement with the surfers, and they obviously can't. So.
There were five designs, and one of the designs, or a couple of the designs, were attempting, because you always get reflections, and I was told that the reflections were done in a way that it would cause minimal problems for the surf break. But obviously the surf club disagreed, I guess. Yeah. I mean, we haven't talked to anyone about this, except we know that Dennis Amor thinks that council staff could have tried a bit harder. My word's not his.
But I don't know whether the rest of the community board will agree with him, because some of them are surfers. So, I think he's probably the only boatie on the community board, isn't he?
Yeah, well, who's the only serious surfer would be Kerry Binnersley.
Yes.
Or Chris. Does Chris surf?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, he looks like he surfs, but just because he's got wild blonde hair. Okay, that's not very... We're getting off a factual base here. Nothing's going to happen, but some people are going to be angry. That's our summary, John?
Yep.
Okay, moving on.
They're carrying on with this project of repainting the water tower up the top of Bow Street. They're also thinking of adding a water fountain to it and lighting, which they stress will be in line with the district plan rules for lighting. So that's minimising the spill of light into the sky and stuff like that. And they've also now got a contract with an artist that's being negotiated. They're planning to do more planting. So there's diagrams of all the plants that they're going to put up there. They're going to put five signs up there to tell you about the mural, the artists, the history of the site, where the water comes from, how much is used, who the sponsors are and such like. They're all going to be bilingual signs as far as I can make out.
Is that five? Oh, five bilingual signs, not five language. Sorry, when I glanced at that before, I was like, what's a five language sign going to look like? What five languages will those be? But it's not, it's just bilingual.
Yeah, five signs which are bilingual. And they hope to be complete by Christmas, so... if you want to see more detail, either have a look at the Whangaroa Environmental Defence Facebook page, or have a look at the council's website and look for the Raglan Community Board agenda on page 17.
Or in December, look at the whole thing when you're driving past.
That's true.
Yes. All right. So that's that. And down at the wharf, what does that say? No fishing signs to be installed. Oh,
this was a discussion.
Not no signs, but signs that say no fishing.
Yes.
But people, weird, just on the boat ramp? No, hold on, John, explain. I'm confused.
I can't explain because neither of us was at the last community board meeting, and this was a discussion which came up then, and the minutes and all the other bits that have been written about it since don't specify where these signs are going. So maybe we'll find out a bit more tomorrow.
Maybe it's just in certain places, because I can't imagine they've going to ban fishing at the wharf, like so many people do that.
Maybe that's why they want to ban it. Maybe there's been some problem, or maybe somebody's got a hook caught in them or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, the previous problem was people falling off the dolphin, but they put
railings
up for that. So, and in a lot of other places around the wharf too.
And as we know, they're resurfacing the boat ramp. So they're hoping to get that finished by the middle of October.
Which I think that's just going all fine. No big deal there.
I was interested to see that Lisa had a meeting with developers of 1 Bankart Street.
And, yes.
I don't know any more about it, so whether she's going to say any more at the meeting, I don't know.
I know.
That's the site next to Foursquare on the corner of the roundabout.
Yeah, so I did have a conversation with her about that, and there are people from out of town, but they're interested in working with the community rather than just turning up and plonking something down. So that's a positive sign.
Good news.
Yeah. That's what I take from that.
Because a large part of that site is road reserve, so any development there needs to be fairly small, which is why they've had such difficulty selling it so far.
Yeah, it was a prime spot, though. And it's also a spot that everyone notices. Those buildings, that and the Vet, are the most obvious buildings when you drive into this part of town. So it's a place for an architectural statement. Something, no offence to the Vets and anyone working there at the moment, but that building's failed to make an architectural statement, but it's not been a particularly attractive one.
Well, some people in the planning department were saying it needed to be 2-storey buildings either side of there to make that statement, and I don't know how well that would go down.
Well, I mean, we're working in a very big building. I actually think that 2-storey is fine. Like design-wise and the feel of it, I think that's perfectly fine. It makes it feel like a 2-story building either side of coming into Bow Street at the roundabout would feel like a gateway into town, and it would match the scale of the Phoenix Palms. So I actually think that's better to be 2-story than 1-story from a design perspective.
Okay, you agree with the planners.
John would like no stories. Well, it would effectively be 3 stories because I imagine you'd have to have parking and you'd put a basement level accessible from Bankart Street to do the parking, but
I thought it looked best with the old batch on the corner with the begonias growing.
Well, that did look cool. Yes, amazingly, like that's the only building being built on that. Is that the only building that was ever built on that site for the entirety of Raglan's township existence?
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? In all that time,
it shows how low density Raglan was at one time.
Oh, if you look at the old photos, there's all sorts of gaps down the main street, and in fact, even when we moved here at the I don't want to say turn of the century, but around 2000, where Isobar is, there was a gap there beside the Duck and Dairy for a long time that just got gradually filled in. So, yeah. Bit of history. What next, John?
Well, we're near the walkways on the agenda again. We've probably got used to the idea that this runs from the jetty to the footbridge. But this is about the southern end of it. They say they've almost finished the northern end. Which they probably will have done this week.
I saw rails up, even though the temporary fencing was still there. I saw rails up, but Dennis was talking about something like anodizing the rails or something like that. So
no,
you
were saying that was the delay in getting them, but I think now that they're there, I think they're done.
Oh, they look like
so they just need to take the temporary railing and the scaffolding down.
They don't look anodized. They look like they're stainless, which would make sense because they're right by the sea. Yeah. Anyway, that'll be clear and ready to go soon.
Yep, so they're now looking at the southern end of that, which is round to the fire station. And they say initial geotechnical investigation has been completed and they'll explore the different construction options to get the best value for money, which is always a good idea, while ensuring that the proposal factors in key items such as the limited access for large machinery. So I don't think we'd learn an awful lot more from that, except that they are going ahead with something and they aren't just going to shelve it because there was the threat of it collapsing if they left it for another 5 years.
Yeah, that other side, there are some big holes in the wall there. Yeah, if you go and have a look, you can see them quite clearly. So
So progress being made there. Progress being made on civil defence as well.
Yep, go ahead. Sorry, John.
They've now got a response plan, which is headed not for public disclosure or something, and there it is in the community board agenda to anyone to look at. I think it's probably on the basis of this is a draft rather than this is a final plan.
They've had that problem before, that they've put names and organizations to be involved but they haven't necessarily got an agreement from them for those people to have their names on there yet.
at some stage it would be good probably to check that those names are still up to date and they've got the correct details for them, because I noticed my email address was wrong on there, which is maybe why I've not heard from them for a bit.
John, they'll be like, let's put John's wrong email address. I've got an old email address for John, so we can say we tried.
No, they didn't even do that. They just changed one letter in it.
Okay, that's just a joke, by the way.
Is it?
I'm joking.
So anyway, we are getting closer to having a plan. There's a list of hazards. There's some very brief instructions in there. As you say, that list of emergency contacts and resources, including people like builders and plumbers and such like, who can repair damage if we have a tornado or whatever.
Yep.
It's got a tsunami map, which I find interesting, looking at Raglan West, that the whole of Raglan West is less than 20 metres above sea level. So if we had a really big tsunami, then Raglan West wouldn't have anywhere to go.
But is that on the map? Is that what that says?
Yes.
Okay.
So
we're not at a terribly great risk of tsunami around here. Okay. Oh, so, yes. But that's
Whangaroa our environmental defence page at the moment. But as I say, it's also on the council's agenda.
So that's on Facebook. So okay. So but that's 20 metres.
Yeah, which is a big tsunami. But the other issue is that we also had a very well-attended meeting talking about the geology of Carrioi. And yes. One of the interesting things that I got from that was that there's quite a lot of offshore volcanoes close to Carrioi.
Just below the surface, apart from Gannet Island or Karewa, as it's also called, known. So what does that mean, John?
Well, it means that we don't actually know what those are doing. There were reports around about 1890, 1900 in the papers that there was some volcanic activity in that area.
Seriously?
Yes. Well, you can never be sure with papers in those days whether this is something to sell a paper or whether it was something that actually happened.
Well, I mean, the geologist who now knows the most about this area has said that they're dead.
Well, he's saying he doesn't know much about them. He simply put them on a map to show where they are.
Oh, the stuff out to sea?
Because when they did the survey for iron sand, they did a survey of magnetic areas, and these showed up on their magnetic surveys that they did when they were looking to mine the iron sand, which, of course, they might still go ahead with, given the fast-track legislation that's going through.
Yeah, so back to that. So the Dr. Oliver McLeod has said that line of cones from Karioi through Porongia has there's been no activity for 2.5 million years or 2.4 million years.
Well, no, he's saying Karioi is much more recent, so that's probably, I've forgotten the exact date, something like 100,000 years ago, which is quite recent
in
geological terms. So that's a separate system from the Karioi volcano.
Oh, okay, right. So that activity that created Karioi and Porongia is from 2.4 million years ago.
It is extinct, yeah.
Yeah, and he said the action that caused that is now back over like around Ruapehu.
Yes.
Yeah, because the tectonic plates have shifted, and so we're not the area where the action's supposed to be. But now I've forgotten,
intraplate activity around Karioi. So, yeah.
Oh, so something could happen. Your screen's gone blank, John. why were we talking about this?
Because of civil defence and whether we might have a tsunami. So I think the answer is that we don't know, because there's not enough work being done to survey the geology of that area. All that's been done is a flyover to find out find out where the iron sand was, and accidentally they found out where some extinct or dormant volcanoes are.
So what do we know about faults? We know there's a fault active earthquake fault out there, because was it the Kaikoura earthquake? It triggered a little bit of a shakeout there, which in turn upset the council water supply a few years ago, and that's when we had water trucks all day coming in to Raglan from over the Divi. So yeah, all sorts of things are possible that you wouldn't expect. We don't expect to have earthquakes here, and no one probably even felt that one, but it did, just was in the perfect place to upset our water supply.
Yeah, so it seems to me that it would be good if some more study was done of those offshore of volcanoes or whatever they are, which maybe it would need to be done by GNS or some other government organisation.
Well, one of the things that Oliver said as well is that there's just no money in geological science at these days, and that's why he crowdfunded his project for Kariwai. And to, and after talking to him, I think as great as the crowdfunding was, I think he did a lot of work basically voluntarily for that project. Yeah,
but a huge tsunami is in the a sort of tiny fraction of the civil defence stuff that's covered by this plan. So they're planning a meeting for the mid-October to finalise the plan and get volunteers willing to put in time to be trained.
Okay.
So that's the news on civil defence, which is good considering it's been on the agenda. Bob McLeod kept pushing it, and finally it seems to be getting there. So
it's been on the agenda since the Christchurch earthquakes.
Probably.
Yeah, and but the guy, Scott, who's the council manager for this, is... he's
Scott Bolt.
Yeah, he's got it actually happening. I think I think that was quite key, and the community board has been reasonably determined to make it happen as well. On to Soundsplash, John. What are we saying there?
Well, they're saying that the improvements implemented for the 2024 event will be continued and expanded for the 2025 events, such as buses coming from Auckland and Hamilton, shade, and faster processing at the security check-in. But staff are still working on how much they're going to charge them for that, because some people on the community board are keen that we get more money for the winery reserve out of Soundsplash. So we'll see where that one gets to.
Yeah, Soundsplash isn't totally over the moon about this idea.
yeah, well, I don't think most people are keen on having extra taxes or charges, but it does put quite a lot of stress on the area for a weekend, and I mean, ideally it would be in the off-peak season rather than still in midsummer.
Yeah.
And whether they can arrange the fees so that there's more of an incentive to have an off-season Soundsplash rather than a mid-season Soundsplash. Maybe it's, that's an option to look at as well.
It's a summer festival. It's only ever going to be in January.
So yeah, it couldn't happen in March or something.
There's so many festivals out there. I think once you've got your weekend sorted, there's probably no other weekends. It's there's so many festivals, John. It's crazy these days. I can't keep up with them. I know you're not aware of all of them either.
Okay. So anyway, there might be some more news on that. Closed circuit television, that's been on the agenda forever. We are supposed to have some CCTV cameras, but I don't know whether they ever worked properly or where they are. But now they say they're gathering data from the New Zealand police to help with prioritisation.
So let me just back up on this a little bit. So there was a lot of concern locally that we need a decent CCTV downtown. And then the government's, the previous government had some funding, which was then given to the district. And now they're working on a program of CCTV cameras throughout the district. They're working with Hamilton City Council because they have a monitoring point, so they're going to work with them as well. But from my perspective, with it starting with a concern from the local businesses about CCTV cameras, I'm a bit worried they're going to be disappointed, because gathering data from New Zealand Police to help with prioritisation of areas and placement for cameras, they might well say, well, Raglan, you have far less problems with security than other communities in the region, and so we might give you one. We might, you know, whereas locals would like maybe five. So that's my comment on that.
Yep. But it looks like things are slowly happening, but they have been slowly happening for a very long time. So,
well, council's always slow, but when councils work together, it kind of like
it gets even slower.
It amplifies the slowness.
Been fairly slow on Greenslade Road Reserve Playground as well. Apparently they're going to share updates with stakeholders, this word that they love using, stakeholders. It seems to me that we're all stakeholders because we all go along and use these things from time to time.
So that's going to happen this year. I read that somewhere else, I'm pretty sure.
It may do.
Yeah, that's... Oh, too many things. I was going to follow a link, but that would take me ages, and then we'd be having silence on the air, so we're not going to do that. John, moving forward quickly.
Yeah. Community board plans, this has been on the agenda for a few meetings now.
But this is, okay, the council wants to make all the community boards have plans. Our community board already has plans, so do we need to say anything?
Well, they've also come up with an hour plan presentation, which I presume they're going to give to the community board tomorrow. On their customer service and costs and safety and risk and things like that.
Also, some staff are coming out to do that.
I noticed that Lisa was saying she'd had a meeting about the Raglan community plan. So I'm not quite sure what all those plans are. We'll maybe find out more tomorrow.
Okay, moving on, the campground, yep. Stormwater projects. This is what I want to talk about, John.
Okay, so it says that the project has been awarded to a company now, GT Civil.
Yes,
they're starting work.
Yes, there's fences up over there now.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I noticed there was a digger over there a couple of days ago, and there's a pile of pipes, surprisingly large pipes, I thought. Almost big enough to crawl through.
There's a lot of water, but that is large. So are they pumping it all back to the like some of the systems over there just pump the water over the sandbank with the hope that it'll dribble out to sea, which it does. But that makes it sound more like they're going to pump everything back into the main system.
Okay. Presumably they've got a plan for it, but I've not seen the plan.
No.
They talk about installing manholes and laying stormwater pipes, and they say the cost was well above the engineer's estimates, so only the stormwater works and the pumping station will proceed and the roading component will be deferred.
What was the roading component for? We don't know. We haven't seen the plans, you just said.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I wanted to say about this was, and the community board chairperson's report that's a part of this agenda, it says that this will deal with the flooding at Papahura at the soccer fields. And I must admit, I rolled my eyes at Dennis when he told me that, because I was like, yeah, sure, I've heard that before. So what I wanted to say was, in 2018, when I was involved with the soccer club, and I'm not sure if that was a year I was chairperson, I tried to shovel the chairperson responsibility off to Luca Grilli, but I ended up looking after the fields for a long time. As the club person, you know, that knows what's going on in the fields. And there was a new manager came into the council in 2018, Ian Cathcart, and he was like, okay, we're going to sort this out properly. We can't just keep treating the soccer fields and the campground as separate entities, because the water is not interested that there's a fence in between the two places. It just flows between the two. So you've got to solve the problem. You've got to solve it for both of them. And he started work on that, and then the council shifted him somewhere else. And then things that I had been promised would happen did not happen. For instance, there's a pipe that comes from the council. There's a pump that sends the pipe through, and it just deposits water into the sandbank right next to the soccer fields. And that had appeared. It had been like that for years, and we couldn't work out why the fields were always so incredibly wet. Well, that was why. But then one year...
Birds like it.
Yeah, yeah. The water popped up to the surface on the sandbank, and you could see what was happening. So I got told that would be fixed, and then 3 years later we discovered it hadn't. So, and I knew, because running construction projects like this is what I used to do before I was doing a job like this. So I knew I was being fobbed off, and I knew they weren't doing it properly. I feel like I was lied to, and it was not a sign of great competence on the council's behalf that they spent quite a lot of money and failed to solve the problem. This time, hopefully, they do solve the problem.
Okay. It seems to me that very often that's something that happens frequently.
I know.
When you're on the other side of the fence, did anyone ever find any effective way of getting you to do something?
I worked for private companies, and Dennis Amor and I have these conversations. We've both worked in the construction industry. He worked on really big projects. No private company would survive with this level of incompetence. I'm really sorry. Like I sometimes think people are too. I often think people are too hard on councils, and they criticise them in ways, in places where council are not doing anything wrong. But this is something that is a constant problem with the council: the turnover of staff, and just the motivation to make sure a job like this is done right is clearly not there. And as everyone in these private companies knows, you just would not last if you operated like this. I don't quite understand how it can be solved. There was an attempt in the 90s to solve it when they made big changes to councils. But
well, 1989, they brought in the larger council. So that's when Raglan County Council became a part of Waikato District Council, together with a few others. So.
There was also an attempt to stop the, like, to open the councils up and stop them being able to use the bureaucratic fog to stop people finding out what was going on. And it kind of worked,
but we still don't know what's going on with lots of these projects.
Yeah, and I don't know what to say, because I know there's good people in council, and I know there's people. There's also people who are just turning up, you know, to get their salary and go home again, and don't really care. But there's an awful lot of good people in there. But this stuff just keeps on happening. And I remember I did piss off one of the managers at the time. I told him that he was getting bullshitted by his people on the ground out here, and he got really annoyed about that. But I was like, I wasn't criticising him. I was just telling him he was having the wool pulled over his eyes, which he didn't seem to like.
Yeah, because I'm never sure whether these people are incompetent, or whether they're not properly briefed, or whether they're too busy, or what the story is. Because we cover a huge area in Waikato District. You know, it goes right up to the Thames Estuary and right up to the Auckland border. So, and we're just down at the southern end of it here.
Yeah, so, well, having the manager who had a good vision for what was going to happen, and then he got shifted somewhere else halfway through the project. I mean, that obviously was not that wasn't good, right?
Yeah, and there doesn't seem to be a good system of passing information on when you replace somebody. They don't seem to inherit a list of here's what needs to be done and here's where I've got to with it.
And the mayor acknowledged that when I interviewed her a couple of months ago. Uh-huh. She said that was something she wanted to attend to. So
maybe she will, but it's not happened yet.
Well, no. I mean, slow, right? Slowly. But she says she wants to, so that's better than her saying, oh, there's no problem at all.
Because maybe this is where we come back to our plan, which I mentioned a while ago as being the answer to how to improve their staffing and the way that their staff work.
What's our plan? Yeah. What's that?
Well, we were talking about community board plans, and they're going to make this presentation to the community board on what they're calling our plan, which is looking, as I say, at customer service, cost, safety, risk, and such like. And presumably that should be partly certainly on the customer service side of it, how to make sure there is this smooth transition when you change people, but there's still a job to be done.
Okay. Is there other stuff you want to add in? Because
I think the only other thing on the agenda that we've not mentioned is the discretionary fund, and they've got their usual $14,271 top up for this year. It never seems to increase with inflation, so effectively it's getting smaller and smaller. And for some reason, the council accounting system doesn't seem to be up to making an up-to-date report on it. So community board's probably got about $10,000 to spare if people want to put in applications over the next year. But they're now looking at doing it every 3 months. So they've gone back to the system we used to have of having deadlines for applications.
It's really funny sitting here, like, watching all this work, and I sometimes apply on behalf of the radio station to the community board, and new people come in and they're like, oh no, we can't possibly do it this way. And then 3 years later, someone else comes again, oh, that's not working, let's do it this way.
And we've gone back to the old system. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked the system where you could just turn up every 6 weeks and make an application. It's very fast. Like, it's quite, a lot of the grant funders, it takes months and months, and it's a very frustrating process. You have to plan so far ahead. And like, we've got problems with like our transmitters failing, or transmitter units failing, and we can't plan for that. We don't know when that's going to happen. So sometimes things just happen. And it was really nice to be able to rock up to the community board. You get a decision instantly on the spot. And you can go off and keep moving. But
so you're going along to tell them that tomorrow afternoon?
No, I just... I didn't think it was worth the effort, that even though I understood this from all this experience I have, I didn't think that it would be taken on board. Maybe I'm doing someone an injustice, but sometimes, John, it's just too hard.
Yeah, maybe that's why we have meetings like we had on Friday, where people are really frustrated about the way that rates are rising and councils aren't being all that efficient, and there must be something wrong. So
Oh, that public meeting. No, I don't want to talk about that, John.
Shall we talk about names of local places?
Yeah, we've just got a couple of minutes left.
They're on the new map that we were mentioning, the one that shows the volcanoes and such like.
Yeah, this is Dr. Oliver McLeod's geological survey of Kurrior and surrounding as well.
Yeah,
And he did. One of the important things to note is he used Matauranga Māori, Māori science, and whakapapa, the whakapapa for the area, which is the historical knowledge that Māori had. And so there's a lot of place names that we're kind of unfamiliar with, but were place names. And one of the things I noticed too, because it comes from a culture where there weren't vehicles, and everyone walked everywhere, there's more place names per square kilometre than we have on our modern maps. I think, yeah, like even the spit over across by the skate bowl has its own name. We just call it the spit. But is it Rookie Kore? I think that's the name of it. Like, that's just an example.
That's
but what
one
else?
Of the names that's not on the map.
That's not actually on the map. Yeah. But yeah, I've been told that one a few times. I think I got it right. But what have you got?
The beach there is Hihi O Tira.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that
which
before.
Which I'd normally known as Wanamu Beach, so I'm not sure whether the two names are synonymous or whether there's one area that's Hihi O Tira or whether the whole thing is Wainamu.
So that spot, is that near where those old World War II lookouts are?
It's near where the recited windsock is, because I don't know if you've noticed, but they keep moving that windsock. It's now onto its fourth location. So
okay.
The tide keeps eroding its base and they keep moving it.
So that bit of the...
One of the things we don't hear about is how much it's costing to keep the airfield open and do things like that.
Well, yeah, don't get sidetracked.
Another place that I think I've seen the name before occasionally is Cox's Bay, round beyond the wharf, between the wharf and the Ransom Bay. And that's got the name Omokaki.
It's not really a bay, is it?
It's got a slight bay shape to it. It sort of has a back to the bay and sides to it, so you can call it a bay.
All right, John, we're splitting. But it does have a Māori name, Omokaki.
Yeah. And the Ransom Bay also has a Māori name, which there used to be a stream group which used the name which is now on the map.
Waikokowai.
That's another name which we can probably start using now.
What about that name down there, Kirikiripu, which is...
Oh, Kirikiripu has been used on the 1 to 50,000 map for a long time, but Kirikiripu is important as far as geology is concerned, because he was explaining that's where most of Raglan comes from. So most of Raglan is based on igneous rock. Certainly all the high ground around Raglan, so...
We're talking that Hills Road there, sort of. Area, aren't we?
Yes, well, in between Hills Road and the main road. So as you come along the main road, as you're heading towards Hamilton, if you look up the hill on your right-hand side, you'll see where Kirikiripu is.
Yeah.
Up the top of there, there were apparently a few vents, and the lava then poured in the direction of Raglan, and it's shown in grey on the map that he's produced. So most of the... government road is mostly on it. Most of the main road is on it. Norrie Avenue is on it. So all those roads at a higher level are on this stuff which came out of Kirikiripu.
Also, Tarapatiki, what's that down there? That, where do we even describe that?
That's the stream which goes to Tumata. So I think that name's been around for quite a bit, but...
Okay, I don't know all the names out there anyway. What else you've got, John? Or is that it?
There's also the Maunga Te Paru, I think I've got the name right. Mongatopuru Road.
Oh, okay, so that ridge line is called, or that area
so
is called?
I expected the ridge line would be called Mongatopuru, but it has got a different name or a different ending anyway.
I wonder what the story is with the naming of that road.
Yeah, maybe we can manage to talk to Anjuine or Sean, who I think came up with most of these names, and find out what the origin of them is.
You were involved with, Dr. Oliver McLeod mentioned your name as someone who used as a source of info for this map. What were you providing? Because you're out with the Raglan Ramblers every Wednesday morning, all over the place. So
yeah, well, initially he was asking for photos of the Ōketi Quarry, and I said, Here's some photos of a Keti, but I've not really got much of a quarry. But here's a few other interesting things you might want to look at. And
yeah.
Most of those ended up in the book. So he did a lot more research. And I now know a lot more about those places than I did when I suggested he looked at them.
Okay. So we've just looked at a tiny bit of the map. If you grab the map and get your magnifying glass out, you can find all sorts of old place names. Well, let's just call them place names.
Or easier still, take a photograph of the map and put it on your computer and enlarge it.
Is that what you did, John? There's a lot of detail on it, a lot of detail. Can we access that? Like, it is made with online, well, with digital. It's a digital map. Can we access it online, or how does that work?
No, everything that I've got from there, I've just taken a photo with my phone and put it onto my computer, which makes it a lot easier to read. Because my only complaint about that book is that it hasn't got an index.
Oh, right. Okay.
The only way to find your way around it is to put it on your computer and search for it on a computer. Otherwise, you're hunting around for all these three letters which are used to indicate what all the rocks are. And if you look them up on the computer, you can find them quickly. But if you're trying to look through 50 pages or so of a book, it's quite hard to find them.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, John. Thank you.
We've reached 5 past 10.
We have.
We're
running late. Yeah. So I guess people are going to, if they've been hearing about this book and this geological map and everything, and they want to find it, I guess they can look up Oliver McLeod online and purchase it.
Maybe it will know where the books are available. I'm guessing that the iHub has got them.
We haven't actually. We need to find that out.
There's also an exhibition going on at the old school.
Oh yes, with their old. There's a fossilized piece of.
Yeah, it's quite interesting looking at the rocks that they've got there.
So that's from before any of the eruptions, 2.65 million years ago.
Old tree trunk and things like that, and that's sitting there.
Yeah.
I just wonder if he's been conned and whether he's actually dated it. It looks to me like any old bit of wood lying around in the corner.
Well, he says he found it. It was at the bottom of
Quarry.
At the quarry. It wasn't Bridal Veil.
No.
Okay.
Though he says it is at the bottom of the falls as well.
Yeah, so he knows.
So it's the layer where the lava ran over the previous landscape,
yeah,
and charred all the wood and preserved
it. And so this is wood from 2.6 million years ago. Yeah. Okay, time to go. John, thank you for coming in. And you're on the air tonight at 6?
Well, 6-ish.
6-ish, with probably playing some of my interviews, but also some more detail about some of the stuff we've talked about too, no doubt.
Yeah, because you did that interview with Dennis, so I was thinking of playing that and maybe commenting that he also mentioned Friends of Wainui objecting to the cycle track.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you have a comment about that, John. You want to give it to us now?
Okay. Friends of Wainui simply said that they didn't represent all the users of the bush park, so it would be good to talk to the users rather than the Friends of Wainui making a comment on their behalf. So it wasn't actually a rejection. It was simply saying, go and talk to the people who use the area and not just a small group of people.
Oh, right. You've been very generous about it. Right. Hmm. All right, John, thank you for coming in. Folks, that is the end of the show for the day. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again tomorrow morning at 8, live on the air.